We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 110. It is going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, and I hope to get it up on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog section. I want to remind you about the book that I wrote, The Kids Are Not All Right, a meme-enhanced primer on encroaching Marxism in the West. It is available on Amazon. It's available for paperback and available for Kindle. If you choose the Kindle option, you can have it in a couple seconds. I want to give a shout out to another podcast out there. It's the Friends Against Government podcast. Throw that into your Google search. Check these guys out. This is one of the funniest libertarian / anarcho-capitalist podcasts you will ever listen to. I'm going to be on their podcast in June. I look forward to it. These guys are freaking hilarious, but they're smart, they're anarcho-capitalists, and they know what they're talking about. Today, I'm welcoming back Rayford Davis. Rayford Davis is a former police officer. He is now a voluntarist / anarcho-capitalist. Rayford does as much as he can to reach out to people who are currently working as police officers, to give them the message of non-aggression, and to teach them that what they're doing is actually harming people, and more importantly, it's harming themselves. Rayford wrote an article for libertarianinstitute.org called Disposable Veterans and Moral Injury. We'll be talking about that article. Without any further delay, here's a recording that I did with Rayford Davis. I want to welcome back to the show once again, Rayford Davis. How are you doing today, Rayford?
Doing very well. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. All right. You wrote an article recently for libertarianinstitute.org that I was very happy to share. I was very happy to read it. I was very happy to share it online. It was called Disposable Veterans and Moral Injury. It's an intriguing title. Tell us why you wrote the article and what it's all about.
Well, you know, I'm on Twitter, and I was following a thread by a journalist named Christopher Morath, and he's a Philadelphia journalist who he focuses on homeless people, drug abuse. He goes around and tests drugs for like fentanyl, cocaine. He's just an avid investigator in opioid overdose issues that we're having going on today. And he met a young homeless man who is a veteran, and an Afghan and Iraq war veteran. And he just kind of told a little bit about this story. Here's this just total, you know, homeless bum, you know, the young man had been arrested 3 times for possession, all during sting ops, targeting dealers. This veteran had got out of Philly's county jails. He's reading this, the snow is falling here in early March. This guy's out on the street, one of our veterans, these people that we honor, and exalt the most of any class in this nation. He's on the street. He joined the army at 18, did a tour in Iraq, and then went back to Afghanistan as a combat engineer. This nameless veteran was in an MRAP when it was hit by an IED. He was injured. Another mission, he had to pull the burned body of his friend from a Striker vehicle. Of course, when he gets back home, he becomes, you know, a 3-time arrested homeless junkie. And so why is that? And the last thing that really struck me when Christopher Morath, he said the last thing he did when he spoke to this man, you know, he said, I want to give you a hug and thank you for your service. And what Christopher wrote is, I could tell from his reaction that it's something he hadn't heard for a while. He agreed to be interviewed for a future episode, and I look forward to introducing you to this veteran. But But Christopher Moraff, not a veteran. He's not a, you know, law enforcement. He didn't know why that veteran kind of had that reaction and that stiffening up or maybe kind of perplexed look when he thanked him for his service. And I know why that veteran reacted like he did. I know why. It's because I felt the same thing as a police officer when people would thank me for my service. And it's because I felt like I didn't deserve it. And that a lot of what I had done as a police officer and what a lot, virtually everything that current military veterans have done in this country have not been very helpful or really even honorable, particularly in the military. If you served in Iraq or Afghanistan, these are two wholly unjust wars. And so when you thank a person for that, and these veterans, they deep down, they know that. They know that something's not right. And so when you thank them, they're like, what exactly did I do? You know, and that's that kind of that why you get that reaction. And I think people see that a lot, and you can't quite understand it. And no one really talks about that moral injury. That's what you're seeing in these young men. They call it PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's similar to it, but it's a little bit different. So, yes, do you get PTSD? Do veterans, law enforcers, do they go through traumatic instances? Yes, you know, people trying to kill you, that is traumatic. You know, being in a tank that gets blown up, that's traumatic. You know, having to see other people suffer, whether it's people around you. You know, I've seen shooting victims and, you know, dead babies and, you know, pulling, you know, children out of, you know, dead children out of car accidents. Yes, that is traumatic and causes stress. I had people try to kill me, had a gun in my face, just like these men. You know, that went over and served in Afghanistan. And was that traumatic? Yeah, it was. But it's the other thing. It's that moral injury. And that's when you do things that harm other people. That's when you do things that are fundamentally morally wrong. Here I'll read a quote from an Iraq war veteran that wrote about moral injury, and Tyler Boudreau. And he defines moral injury as about the damage done to our moral fiber when transgressions occur by our hands, through our orders, or with our connivance. When we accept these transgressions, however pragmatically, we sacrifice a piece of our moral integrity. That is what moral injury is all about. Moral injury does not replace post-traumatic stress, but it works alongside it. And so when you harm another person unjustly, you suffer moral injury to your own body. You inflict that harm to yourself in your own spirituality. And it doesn't matter if you're wearing a uniform. It doesn't matter if you are under orders. It doesn't matter if what you're doing is legal. Orders, government laws, badges, uniforms, good intentions will not shield you from the consequences of this fundamental moral principle. When you harm another person unjustly, you commit a fundamental wrong, particularly with the use of violence where you harm another person. You inflict a more damaging spiritual and emotional damage to yourself. And this is an inescapable fact of humanity. And, you don't even have to kill anyone. You talk about these veterans and they say, well, you know, I was never in combat or anything like that, but I have this PTSD from my experience in Iraq. And so why is that? And you don't have to kill anyone. Any violations of another man's right, however slight, inflicts enormous spiritual damage on yourself. Even the lowest supply clerk who never fired a shot, he shares that culpability for he chose, he made that decision to choose to join and choose to go over and put his boots on the ground in another person's country and threaten them with violence and death. And thousands were violently killed, starved, homes invaded. You harm yourself. Oh, it was all legal. All the orders were moral. Oh, you know, our invasion of Iraq. Oh, that was just totally the whole weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, we know that was pretty much a lie now. But since I had orders, it's all good. And no, that's not right. You can't just walk away from it like that. And why is moral injury more damaging and more harmful than really even the PTSD from going through traumatic events? Is because it's made more, all that trauma is made more unbearable, completely soul destroying to you. Because deep down in your gut, you know that what you did was unnecessary, not heroic, and worse, it was in furtherance of an unjust purpose. Now, if you ask a veterans about this, they may deny it. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, self-inflicted moral injury, it's difficult to comprehend and to accept. So, I mean, the hardest word you've ever got to say is, I was wrong. And you harmed someone? You killed someone? You went in over to another country and you kicked in the door of someone's house, shoved guns in their faces, you know, ostensibly to protect them. But that's not what you were doing. That's not what you were doing. You were the violent aggressor. And I did the same thing as a police officer in fighting the drug war here at home, kicking in doors, shoving in guns, people's faces, dragging them out of cars. I did the exact same thing. Oh, I had orders. It was all legal. You know, I was a good guy. Sure, I had questions about the mission, just like the veterans in Iraq and Afghanistan. But hey, that's on them. No, I made that choice. George Bush, he didn't kick any doors over there. He didn't bomb anyone or shoot anyone at a checkpoint. No, he didn't do that. Men like me and this guy who's now, you know, just a homeless junkie in Philly. He's the one that made those decisions. And see, the leaders know this. And this is when I talk about the disposable side. Why is disposable veterans? Is because these leaders and these elites and all of these people, see, they don't get their hands dirty. And they understand these cosmic karma moral culpability laws and how they work. And so they know that it's the person who makes that individual decision. See, groups don't act. Governments don't act. A branch of the military doesn't act. It's as an individual person that makes that decision to cause that harm to another person. That's the one because with your actions, you're the one that pulls that trigger. You're the one that points that gun at a person. You chose that action, and it's actually you bringing that harm into physical manifestation. The orders you got were just ink and paper. It's you that created that harm and brought it into existence, and so therefore you bear that greatest moral burden and that moral injury. And those leaders, you see, now they can lie to you and kind of deceive you a little bit. And in their thinking, that shields them, which it does. It does shield them from the moral consequences. You bear the greater burden for it. That's because you have free will. You chose. If you say, well, I was just following orders, you're denying your own free will.
Yeah.
When we have the disposable women, these people, they do that. They have a very good understanding of how morality and culpability is distributed. They have no problem speaking clever deceptions, but they never get their own hands bloody. They don't want that liability. They get you to do that for them. And that's why they take the best men. That's we want hey, people that you want to fight for freedom, you want to serve your country, they give all these platitudes. They pick the strongest men. That's who they want. Why do they do that? Because these guys are the kind of like the toughest and the best men in our country. And they would be dangerous to these leaders. So what do? They trick you. And they put you on their payroll. And they get you to do their dirty work for them. And then when you're done, now you're broken and confused, and they throw you away. And they mock at you. And I think, you know, I think a lot of them are very just, you know, just basically, you know, they're evil and malevolent individuals, and they gain strength from that. We got all these veterans walking around, highest suicide of suicide rates, military and law enforcement have these extremely high suicide rates. Why is that? And that's because they bear that burden. Those leaders don't. They deceive you. And by saying, well, don't blame me, you know, blame your politicians. I had good intentions. I was just following excuses. No, you chose to follow those orders. You allowed yourself to be deceived. There's a certain comfort in letting others make those decisions for you. Hey, it's fun, you know, for a while, you know, smashing stuff, blowing things up, driving fast, kicking in doors, shooting guns. These guys give you permission when no one else will. And then you come home and you bear those burdens, and then they call it PTSD, and so they do treat that, hey, you have this moral suffering, but they never say exactly, yes, you are suffering this moral injury because what you did was unjust, because the entire war was unjust, and because you harm people unjustly. They can never admit that, because that would show their own culpability. So, and you can't begin to heal. These men are suffering. But, go ahead.
I don't remember if it was in your article or if it was in another article I read on libertarianinstitute.org, but I was reading an article and it said that the incidence of soldiers committing suicide because of PTSD is minuscule. Most of them have depression. They don't want to leave the house. You know, they have a lot of problems. So the only thing that they can attribute this, you know, rash of suicides, this 22 a day, is guilt. Because, you know, there's all studies have shown that people that have genuine PTSD symptoms are not suicidal. Was that your article, or was that something else I read?
That was, that was, I think, Matthew Ho, who is Army lieutenant, and he says, you know, he says the same thing. Hey, it's moral injury. It's war guilt. And see, the VA and, you know, all of your, institutions and psychiatrists and psychologists will say, well, that's things you had to do. And they twist it around like, look at that sacrifice. Yeah, you've got that 1,000 yards there. Oh, that's just a measure of how much you sacrificed, and it's so honorable. No, committing injustice and harming people is never honorable. And so that, again, that prevents people, these men, from healing, and because you confuse them, and they're like, why am I suffering? They're telling me what I did was good, but I'm cracking up inside, and it festers. The only way to begin to heal that is to, first, you have to admit what you did was wrong and unjust. You have to admit that your laws and orders did not they can't absolve you from the fundamental moral consequences of your actions. So you have to admit it's wrong. You have to admit you harm people. You have to admit that you didn't have to do it. And then, that's only then can you proceed with your healing.
We've talked. This is the fourth time you're appearing on the on my podcast, and that ties you with Scott Horton for most for most appearances. But I don't think I've ever asked you this question before. Now, it's very it's very well known that soldiers come home, especially people who are in infantry, you know, people who are in battle, and there it's hard for them to find a job, you know, because of their specialty. So a lot of them turn to law enforcement. When you were, you know, when you were in North Charleston, right?
That's right.
Was there a high incidence of people being hired who were former infantry, former military?
You know, we did. And, you know, I served in the Coast Guard before I, you know, joined law enforcement. And that was part of, you know, why I went. Well, because, you know, when I was young, I really couldn't get a job as a cop. So, but the military would take me, you know. Hmm. And so I signed up there. And, you know, and so that was always kind of my plan was, you know, military / you know, law enforcement, you know, to serve my community. And it is just like, you know, a lot of men. We had a lot of guys that were former military. You know, Charleston's a big military town. So we did have a lot. Did that influence how they acted? It's a mixed bag, you know, quite frankly. It's a mixed bag. Some of them, yeah, you could tell they kind of brought that military bearing a little too much over to their police work. And, but some of them, you know, a lot of them were actually more mellow because in some ways, it's particularly with use of force, which is fascinating, they were more restricted with their use of force training in the battlefield than we were at home. As a police officer.
I've heard that.
So some were kind of a little too gung ho, but others were like, "Whoa, dude! You know, this is crazy. You know, what our use of force policies and how our you know law enforcement training is just, you know, you guys are just totally unaccountable, and this is how you get people shot accidentally and unnecessarily, you know."
Yeah, I wanted to ask you. There was a meme going around for a while that made a claim about the percentage of law enforcement spousal abuse, and numbers were between 35% and 40%. And you know, basically, what the meme was all about was, you know, the thin blue line is going to protect, you know, the abuser, because the abuser is a police officer. Why do you think that's such a high, there's such a high percentage in the law enforcement field?
You know,
I'm not trying to, I would never try and do a gotcha,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A gotcha question.
Hey,
but,
hey, it's Mother's Day. You know, I've been married to my wife for 25 years. You know, and she's been a wonderful mother to two kids. And you know, if I always treated her well, you know, absolutely not. You know, and did I bring stresses home from the job and take it out on her unjustly? I sure did. I did. And, you know, and a lot of people do in a lot of their jobs. You know, I don't know. I'll tell you, and let me turn this around a little bit.
Sure.
What I think is interesting is how I treated women, particularly like with drug enforcement. So here I'm a cop out on the street, and I would come in contact with some, you know, some woman, whatever, you know, that has some type of drug issue, you know, and I would take her. Okay, say she doesn't even have to have drugs on her. She could just have a crack pipe, and that's an arrestable offense. And so I would take a woman like that, and I would grab her because she's trespassing or she was in a car that didn't have a turn signal on long enough, and I would take them and yank them out of their car and put my hands all over them, grab them up, searching them, find a crack pipe or just a little piece of you know, something, little joint or anything like that. And I would arrest them. I would take them and I would put handcuffs on them. And if they resist, man, I'd shove them into the ground and wrench their arms behind their back. And I'd put those handcuffs on good so they wouldn't slip out, because you've got to watch them women, you know. And then I would take her and I would take her belongings away from her. And then I would lock her in a cage and she couldn't come out for a week. And she'd have to pay $1,000 to get out. And, you know, imagine if I treated my wife like that. I would never, imagine my wife had an alcohol problem or something. And I took her because my wife, spoke pot. And I took my wife and I grabbed her, threw her down, locked her in a cage, beat her if she tried to get out, held her in there for a week. I would be the most vicious, despicable man and the most dishonorable individual. Yet, that's what law enforcement does to women. That's what they do every day. They're treating people just like that. Mothers. Mance, we just watched a video of Alpharetta cops pulling a 65-year-old woman out of a car.
Yep.
Calling an F word up and down, dragging her out, yanking her around, cinching those cuffs on, all because she swerved in her lane and she wouldn't sign the ticket. Treat her like total scum. And you imagine if I was riding the car with my mother and she drifted in her lane a little bit and I beat on her like that because she drifted in her lane. I would be the, and caught that, and they caught that on video. Man beats mother. Horrible abuser. Oh, but cops do it, and it's okay. So let me turn that around. That's how we you know, particularly on Mother's Day here, that's how we treat women. It's horrible. Disgusting. We would never treat our own mothers like that, our own wives. Yet that's what we do, particularly for these what I call non-crime offenses. That we do every day. You know, thousands of people, world's largest incarcerator, United States arrests and incarcerates more of its population than any other country by a mile. And that's law enforcement doing that. That's law enforcement pulling those people out of those cars, hooking them up. Now, some of it's legit. There's real crime. But a lot of it's not. And it's unjust and unnecessary. And it makes you, the police officer, you're the violent person. And that causes moral injury, too, when you harm people unjustly like that.
Well, you were talking about this Alpharetta cop, and, I mean, that's literally 10 minutes from where I live. This is a quote of, apparently, he's resigned. And this is a quote from his resignation letter. He said, "I did what was necessary to complete the arrest by raising my voice and using verbal commands, using heavy control talk with profanity." And I posted that up on Twitter today, and my comment was, and this is inspired by something that I heard Michael Malice say once, was, "If you desire to have a job where you raise your voice to other adults and you rifle through their belongings, you really need to examine your own character. Because that's a job that no one should desire." I mean, he's basically making excuses and saying everything that everyone saw in that video was exactly what he was trained to do.
He's right. He was following his training, except for the F-bomb. But other than that, yes. That's how I was trained. And now let me talk from a cop perspective for just a moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to justify this, but if that was like a North Hollywood shootout gunman, like a real criminal or something, I would have no problem with yelling or cursing. It's often not the best, but sometimes it does work, and to be that quick and kind of aggressive can prevent harm to everyone. And so just in a confrontational interaction way, Sometimes that can be kind of, you know, a legit way to do it. But here's the deal. This woman, I mean, she's like my mother. She's a 65-year-old lady trying to drive down, Georgia 400 at night. You know, that ain't easy. Now, you could watch from the video. The lady was asking, I want to see a supervisor. And you could tell maybe something was a little off with her. Not that she was drunk or anything, but you could tell. I'm going to make an assumption that maybe kind of medically or something, or that she may have just kind of been a little off.
Well, then she's a victim, and she needs to be taken care of.
And so the beginning officer, and I hope you'll put a link to the video for that so people can watch. The initial officer, he pulls her over for her swerving, and so he's going to give her a ticket and then send her on her way, which is kind of weird, because if she's really a danger, how is giving her a ticket and then sending her back out onto the highway helpful? But so the initial cop's not really, he's trying to get going. But the lady's being, I want a supervisor. And you say, well, she's being obstinate and a little ornerier, and she bringing this on herself for not complying. And, maybe a tiny bit, but then the officer's like, well, you're going to have to sign this citation. Which, now in South Carolina, we didn't make people do that. And that's just as dumb as dirt. I mean, that's just like a really it's just like a humiliating act. You better sign this,
Well, if you read the bottom of a ticket in Georgia, basically it's like they describe it almost as, by putting your signature down, you're setting bail. Because if you don't put your signature down, I'm going to arrest you right now.
Right.
That's the language on the bottom of a ticket. So basically, by signing, you're basically bailing yourself out of jail at that moment.
Yeah, and it's so ridiculous. It's just this little, just one of these other just a million of inane little conformance or subservience rituals that police officers subject citizens to, and so of course people balk at that. And this, like, you could tell she was a little scared. Of course everyone is when they're pulled over, especially at night. And oh yeah, she happens to be black, and so she, her understanding of how law enforcement, she's actually, she doesn't like cops so much, which I understand. She has a right to, to feel that way, and so she wanted a supervisor. But this officer decided no. He's not going to wait for a supervisor. She didn't want to sign it, so she's under arrest, and they start snatching her out of the car. Get out of the car, get out of the car. He calls other cops, and they come running, dragging her out of the car, and arresting this lady all over because she wouldn't sign the ticket. Totally insane. Just absolutely insane.
There's a couple states now. I think New Jersey is one of them, where what they do is when they print out the ticket, your signature actually appears on the ticket and it's taken from your driver's license. So basically they have it stored, and when the officer prints out the ticket, your signature is already pre-stamped basically on the ticket. And I think they do it that way in a few states now as well.
Right. And so, I can just see my mom being treated like that. I mean, if she's that much of a danger to the people on the road, then help her. Hell, you got 8 freaking cops there. Let one of them drive her to somewhere safe. I mean, that would be honorable. That's how cops earn respect, is going that extra mile. Yeah, the lady's a little rude or something, but I mean, daggum, she's somebody's mama, and so help her out. Yeah,
it's a disrespect thing, man.
Oh, and you ain't got too much time. Oh, well, your supervisor came and visited you now, officer. How'd that work out for you? Now you're on TV, officer, looking like a total jerk, which you are. And I know you're sitting there, well, we followed policy and everything, which you did. And here's the Alpharetta chief and everything. Well, this officer, they threw him under the bus too. Yeah, mm-hmm. Officer Legg. They threw him. Oh, that's, you know, that's only because they got caught and there's a row about it. That's the only reason that they're forcing him out is because, yes, you are trained that way. Now, if you look at their written policy, it won't show it that way. It'll be worded a little different, and they'll be able to show you how they violate. But that's how cops are trained, because that's how I was trained. That's how I acted sometimes. I'm not proud of it. That's how I acted. And you take out this person. This is total non-crime. This woman's not some violent terrorist or bank robber or anything like that. She doesn't deserve to be treated like that. She deserved to be helped.
Yeah, man.
And so law enforcement, they lose all respect. And then police officers, they can't. Some of their work is actually legitimate. And they won't even be able to do that job because no one will respect them. No one's obligated to. Cops think the people obligated to respect them? No. That's on you. You're an armed government agent, man.
Oh, they demand it, man.
Demand?
They demand it in freaking New York. I remember Dave Smith talking about that he was, you know, they were smoking a joint on some street, on a street that was like a block over from a precinct in Manhattan. And when two cops caught him smoking a joint, and it wasn't like, oh, you're doing something wrong. It's like, our precinct is one block over. Why are you disrespecting us like this?
Right.
It's like, what the hell is that, man? How, I mean, respect goes two ways in life everywhere. Everywhere in the world, respect goes two ways, except when you're dealing with a group that has a monopoly on force.
Right.
Then respect only is supposed to go one way. And so many people in this society have bought into that garbage. I mean, it is just that they would not have the power they have if people didn't buy into the fact that they're untouchables.
And I did. And so let's kind of put that together. We have, you know, we have the veterans that fight these unjust wars, harm thousands of people. We know these Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia and whatever the other 8 other countries that were bombing and killing people is horribly and just has nothing to do with our self-defense. It's all immoral. And so it's men. It's men like you and me who make that decision. I want to sign up and serve. It's you. You're the one causing that harm. You're going to suffer that moral injury. The leaders and stuff that you obediently support, they know this. They mock you when you come home and you're a broken and confused person. Police officers, you do the same thing. You think you're a good guy and you're helping. You do a little bit, but law enforcement has always, it is designed. You are an armed government agent. That's what you are, and law enforcement has always been designed. It is a tool of a violent oppression and control. That's what its main purpose is. Yeah, it does some good here and there and everything, and there's good guys there, but that's what you are, and you cannot reform that, and you don't. There's no honor in serving in that or doing a good job there. You are not helping anyone, and you will ultimately, if you're not a psychopath, you will morally destruct at some point. So make that decision. Take culpability for your own actions. Stop using the excuse, hey, it's the law, or I have orders. That is wrong. You're being fooled, and do what you can to step away from that.
I can't think of a better place to end it. Thank you so much. Do you have anything going on that you want to plug?
No, you know, just I'm on Twitter, so Rayford D. So follow me there, and
I'll put a link to your Twitter in it.
Thank you for what you do.
Oh man, oh thank you. I mean, you have way more guts than I do. When it comes to this, Twitter.
Let me speak to some guys. I know you have lots of veterans and you know, kind of former, you know, kind of law enforcement community people that listen to you. And just let me tell you, man, you know, I came out, you know, my pinned Twitter tweet whereas everything I believed about drug prohibition was wrong, my violent actions enforcing those laws harmed others and injured my own moral fiber. I put that out in July of 2015, and man, I was scared when I put that thing out there like that. And I have had nothing but positive responses from everyone. And I am very hard on law enforcement. I do that because I care about those guys. I know they wanted to do what's right, but they're causing immense harm and themselves. It's not because I hate them. I hate what they do. And I did the same stuff. And I love them, and I want them to change. And so you guys out there, if there's other men like me, I have had almost zero negative responses. It's all been extremely positive. And y'all see my Twitter line, and I am very hard and uncompromising on law enforcement. And I've had nothing but positive responses for it. And I'm doing the right thing. Man, as a cop, people, you know, we'd have calls for like armed robberies and shootings, man. And I went. I didn't turn my back on that. I went, you know, and I had to step out of my car. And, you know, there could be some guy that just shoot me right in the head. But I got out, you know, hey, diddle, diddle, walked right up to the front door, you know, and if I can do that, then by God, I can speak the truth out on Twitter.
Man, I love talking to you. I look forward to the next time. I want to talk to you the next couple of days privately about your trip. I think, anarchists such as myself, always thinking, well, if things get really bad, I gotta go. might want to go somewhere else and everything. And where you just visited is always one of the places that I've thought about. Although I definitely have to go there before I would make a decision like that. So,
all right. Well, thank you, Mance, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, man. I appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you. All right. Thank you, Rayford. I want to thank you for tuning in to episode 110 of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Rayford for again coming on. What a great guest. I want to remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right. Check it out on Amazon. And I look forward to coming back to you on the weekend with another podcast. So take care, have a great week, and bye.